Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest great adventure from Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, how are you this very day?
Well, absolutely fine, apart from the fact that it's so cold in London at the moment. It's like being in Verbier, isn't it?
I can't believe it, right? So I go into my roof garden every morning to refill the bird bath, okay? It doesn't empty overnight, but I like to clean the water and all that kind of stuff. For the last three mornings, the bird bath has been frozen solid. And I don't mean, you know, where you can sort of tap it with your finger and break the ice. I'm talking about solid. I can't believe how the temperatures overnight have dropped to -3, -4, and the bird bath, which is always my sort of barometer of what the weather's like, doesn't even go liquid till 11 o'clock in the morning. It's extraordinary weather.
So do you find you get an influx of poor, thirsty birds landing on your roof terrace because they can't get it anywhere else?
Listen, when they land on the bird bath and I watch them, it's part of my sort of mental health therapy. The poor birds sometimes land and then skid off, if you see what I mean, like an aeroplane landing on a runway that doesn't take tyres, you know what I mean? And I, the first thing I do every morning is a boiler kettle, go out there, try to unfreeze the bird bath, but if it's solid, you can't. And all that happens is after about 10 minutes, the water you've put on top freezes again. So it's a bit worrying. But what you have to do is just keep taking out trays of water for the birds. Anyway, sorry, this is not a bird sanctuary story.
Sounding like a twitcher, Michael.
Yeah, well, I'm not a twitcher. I tell you, was a twitcher, actually, and quite amazed me. Do you remember Wolfman of Fleet Street?
Neil Wallace.
Yeah, he was called Wolfman because at one stage during his career, he had a incredible beard like around most of his face, and his teeth were a bit prominent, so we used to call him Wolfman. I worked with him at a couple of newspapers, and he got rid of his beard and all that. But he secretly was a bird watcher, but he never told anybody because he thought it was a bit sort of fey, if you see what I mean, you know, to be both a, you know, rock hard Fleet Street executive going around, you know, bashing people about and tough guy and all this kind of stuff. And he wouldn't admit to anybody for years he was a bird watcher. Do you think that's an interesting sort of insight into a character?
Are we talking about the same kinds of birds?
No, definitely. I mean, feathered birds, seriously. I mean, you know, he did work on The Sun when Page 3 was in its at its height and all that kind of stuff. But no, seriously, he used to travel like hundreds of miles to Norfolk and places like that when he was on one of these what do they call them, twitcher-type networks. And all of a sudden, you know, the great golden-crested newt had flown in from Siberia. And woof, you know.
I don't think newts can fly, actually.
Mike. Well, you know what I'm talking about. You know, the great... yeah, sorry, no, not a fly.
Maybe you mean the eagle. The eagle has landed.
The eagle has landed and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, there we are. Now, Miss Jones, of course, you've rubbed shoulders with the great and the good and the wealthy for most of your life in terms of showbiz and all that. Deck Donnelly of Ant and Dec, right, suddenly finds out in the middle of the night that his £5 million house has been the subject of a raid. You know, criminals have tried to break in through his gate, get to his house. And in the part of London where he lives, West London, I assume, sort of Notting Hill or something like that, I don't know, it was the 110th attempted burglary, some which were successful and some which weren't, in that part of town in 6 months. Even when you're wealthy and think that you're immune in life from all these sort of things, it must be terribly worrying, particularly if you've got a family, you've got children in your house, to think that because of your success and your wealth in life, you're going to be targeted all the time by people like this.
Well, of course, you're less safe. The more money you have, the more impressive a home you have, the less safe you are because you are more of a target. And you are a sitting target. They know who you are. They know where you live. And they know that you've got valuables inside. It's like when you live in an enclave or you stay in a sort of enclave, which I've done a few times in my life, you know, you go to one of these resorts, such as in Nairobi or Watamu or somewhere like that, or in the Caribbean, and you've got these very exotic five-star hotels, which are within an enclosure with locked iron gates and very high walls and kind of nets surrounding these places.
Yeah.
But they know where you are, and they know you've got money, and they know that there are rich pickings inside. Yeah. So I think you probably feel a lot less safe the more you have.
Well, that's a very interesting observation. You talk about those enclaves. There's one in South Africa, and I can't remember what it's called now, but it's, you know, South Africa is an amazing country. It's got great wealth in parts of it, but great poverty in others. I mean, some of those townships that you read about are 10 miles wide and 30 miles long. You know, you think of a township as being like, you know, the size of a field or something like that. They're huge cities, you know what I mean? But then you can go, you know, 20 miles down the coast on the Cape or something like that, and vast wealth. People have estates of hundreds of thousands of acres where they grow grapes to manufacture wine and all that kind of stuff, you know. But there's one particular area there, and I must admit I can't remember what it's called now, but Mrs. Thatcher's son lived there, Mark Thatcher, and you're absolutely right, it's a fortress. And of course all the poor people from the townships know exactly where it is, and they have to have huge security measures to stop them getting in. I'll tell you who lived there. Pistorius, you know, the guy who was
Oscar Pistorius,
and he lived there. And of course, the historic and tragic story about Oscar Pistorius is that he achieved greatness in life. He lost his legs. He became a para-athlete, you know, like an athlete in Paralympics, but the first man to then take part in able-bodied Olympics, you know, with his blades on the end of his legs and all that. And in the end, went to jail because he was mad, and he blew his girlfriend away in one of those enclaves. And the problem was, it was so secure conscious, nobody could get there to save the poor girlfriend.
Yeah, it was a dreadful story. Oh, I remember following that. My son actually was obsessed with that story because he was a big fan of Oscar Pistorius.
Yes.
And he couldn't believe what happened. And he was convinced that Pistorius was innocent and that it would turn out that somebody had broken in and had actually killed her while Oscar was asleep and all that kind of thing. Yeah. But the coverage on Sky News was relentless. It was 24/7, day after day after day.
Yeah.
And yes, of course he did it. It was obvious from the outset that he killed her, but the defense was more and more surreal by the day.
Yeah, it was. I totally agree. And from a woman's point of view, that was one of the most hideous crimes ever. She started, and she was a beautiful girl, his girlfriend, you know, beautiful girl, and the family were in the court every day and all that kind of stuff. Riva, Riva, remember him shouting, you know, Riva. And she simply said something which he didn't agree with, and he thought, no, I'm not having that. So he got out of bed without his blades and straddled across the floor, picked up a gun and blew her to death through the bathroom door. I mean, what kind of a human being can do that?
Well, he was obviously detached from his senses, wasn't he? And, of course, he had form with gun crime before. He'd wielded guns at lunch parties in restaurants and that kind of thing. And I think the problem is when you live in a culture like that where the gun is so much part of the culture and it loses its authority, it loses its danger and it becomes almost a toy.
Yeah.
And you need a gun to protect yourself in a place like that because it's lawless, largely to a huge extent. Right. And in a country, in an environment where you have haves and have-nots and nothing in between, and the desperation on the part of those with nothing at all becomes the thing that you have to protect yourself from.
Yeah.
The great irony being here that the person she was most in danger from was the love of her life.
In bed with her, not just in the house, but in the same bed as her. I totally agree. An extraordinary
story. Really sad. The mother, Riva's mother, wrote a heartbreaking book about her experiences. And, you know, they've never come to terms with that. They pop up in the news every now and again.
Yeah.
And, I mean, who would? You've got to live with that horror for the rest of your own life, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, he's still in jail because initially he got a very light jail sentence because it was sort of commuted to manslaughter. And then there was an appeal put in and he got resentenced. So fortunately, he's still there. But there you go. You're right about the gun culture. The first time I went to South Africa, I couldn't believe coming through Johannesburg Airport. There's like this room and you have to go in it and you have to empty the bullets out of your gun before they'll allow you into the country. You know what I mean? It's extraordinary. And you know, you sort of look around, you think, hang on, I've just got off an aeroplane and the person next to me has actually got a gun. An extraordinary culture. But anyway, there you are. I am happy to say that I once broke the poverty cycle for a person in South Africa. What happened was I was in a hotel in Cape Town. It was during the 2010 World Cup and I had to go somewhere else. I don't know where it was, you know, but it was about an hour's drive away or something like that. So the guy picks me up, young chap in a really broken down car, you know, sort of the only sort of taxi you can get sometimes in Cape Town. And after about 10 minutes, he said, "I'm sorry, sir, but we've got to divert now because I have to go to my friend's house." And I said, "What's that for?" He said, "I'm running out of petrol. And my friend has got a gallon of petrol he can give me." So I thought, either this guy's going to sort of kidnap me, you know what I mean, because I'm a rich sort of Westerner or something like that, maybe take my money and my lot of that, or this guy's got a serious problem. I said, no, you don't need to go to your friend's. There's a filling station up the road. I can see it from here. Go there and fill your car up. He said, "I can't. I haven't got any money." I said, "Well, I have. Go and fill it up." "Oh, okay." So we drove in, he filled it up. I paid for the petrol. The boy was elated. He couldn't believe it. He had a full tank of petrol, right, for the first time in months. And that broke his poverty cycle because he wouldn't then have to stop driving his car every time he ran out of the 1 gallon of petrol he could borrow from his friend.
Oh, it's a sad and an uplifting story, isn't it, really? Yeah,
absolutely. When I got to wherever I was going, I gave him another $20 or something, you know, I can't remember what it was in those days, Rand, I think. Gave him another sort of £20 or something like that. And I made the boy's life. And I know it's very selfish, but I felt so good about myself by being able to help. But it does illustrate the disparity in wealth around the world, doesn't it?
Well, it's everywhere. And of course, you know, we tend to blinker ourselves from it. I think a lot of people get up and walk out of the room or they switch off mentally when those ads come on the television appealing for, you know, give £3 a week or £3 a month to save this child's eyesight through Save the Children or whatever.
Yes, I agree.
I think there's a lot of compassion fatigue around nowadays.
Oh, Leslie.
We've almost become immune to it.
You're so right. But you know what the problem is? There's too many adverts like that. And I can't make up my mind which to give to. I think I've told you this story before. I used to give £100 a month to Sight Savers, okay? And, you know, I was really moved by these adverts. Little kids whose their eyelashes on their eyes curl in on them, on their eyeballs. It's horrific to watch the advert, you know, and horrible. And I used to give £100 a month. And I'm sure I've told you this story before. Eventually, I wanted to try and do more. So I got a letter from the CEO, Sight Savers, saying, you know, "Thank you, Mr. Parry, for being, you know, one of our prime donors and all that. Would you like to up your contribution to £150 a month? You know, and it's not the current CEO, Sight Savers, by the way. This is about 4 or 5 years ago. And I thought, so they're asking me for more money. I'm going to be proactive here. And being a journalist and a communicator like you, I decided to email her, the lady who sent me the note, and suggest that we could actually go to Africa and make a documentary and put that out, and that would in turn generate a lot more interest for her charity. Anyway, when I rang her PA and said, "Hi," explained who I was, and I'd like to communicate, she said, "Oh, no, I'm sorry. The CEO doesn't take individual emails from donors." I said, no, you don't understand. I'm trying. No, I'm sorry. If we allow one donor to communicate individually to the CEO, then I'm afraid it'll open the floodgates. And I just cut off my £100 a month because I wasn't going to stand for that.
I get that. I do understand. The thing I always feel a little bit wary of with these charities is that they have a vast professional staff, such as the CEO you've just described.
Yeah.
And I know one or two people who work for these big charities, and they get paid a lot of money.
Oh, they do.
So you're never quite sure where your donation is going, is what I'm saying.
I totally agree. Their offices are in sort of, you know, glass and silver palaces in the centre of London. They don't need to be. They could have their headquarters in Hartlepool and pay, you know, 1/10 of what they pay in London. But anyway,
was a time when sort of rich ladies who were married to, you know, titled and wealthy men who didn't need to work. Mm. Those were the kind of people who ran charities in the good old days.
You agree.
Because they didn't do it for the money. They did it for reasons of compassion and wanting to give back.
I totally agree.
That's all gone badly wrong because charity is a big profession now.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with all of what you said. Downton Abbey, I don't know if you ever watched it, but it's one of my favourite shows ever, Downton Abbey, the TV series.
Yeah, I watched it once or twice. Yeah.
And of course, it went through the First World War and they turned Downton Abbey into a hospital. And you're absolutely right in what you just said. The dowager and all the ladies ended up as nurses. And that's, you're so right. That's kind of where charity started, you know?
Yeah, charity does begin at home.
It does indeed. Talking about neighbours, by the way, we were talking about deck and the problems like that. Have you ever had a neighbour problem which has been so serious you've had to move?
No, I haven't. And I'm very fortunate because I know some people have really suffered in that regard.
Unbelievable. If you own a property or live in a property, you are always going to have problems. I've had situations where I thought this is, intolerable. I'm leaving, I'm moving. And then you move into another one, and you find that something else happens. You know what I mean? You've got to accept in life that you're going to have problems with neighbours. Old Deck there, you know, get people trying to break into his house. That happens to a lot of footballers, by the way, who live in Merseyside, or, well, in the north west of England. You know, they live in huge houses in Cheshire or Formby or Southport or somewhere like that. And as you quite rightly say, because people know they've got wealth, people break in all the time. I had one situation once where I bought this new house in a nice new street and all that kind of stuff. And the guy next door was a young fella, go-getter, and what he did was he had what you'd call, in our parlance as journalists, a cherry picker, okay? And this cherry picker, you know, for the benefit of our listeners, it means that you've got a van, and on the back of it, you've got a hydraulic arm which lifts a basket up. In our terms, Leslie Ann, that's for a journalist who's, you know, viewing something from the basket, the cherry picker, but he was mending lights for local authorities. So, you know, when a bulb went or when, you know, something had happened to the light, he'd go and do it. So we got on okay until he bought a second cherry picker to expand his business, and he parked his second cherry. The first one was on his drive. That's fair enough. No problem. Second one, he parked on the road right in front of my house and took all the light out of my kitchen. And it got so bad that we ended up not speaking. And in the end, I sold the house. And I didn't actually. I rented it out when I bought another house. But problems with neighbours can blight your life.
Oh, yeah. I've got a very dear friend who's having a terrible problem with this at the moment.
Yeah.
She lives in one of those lovely Victorian houses in Southeast London,
yeah.
Which is on a street of all the same architecture. And it's been preserved over the years so that, you know, to maintain the flavour of the neighbourhood, as it were. Her next door neighbours, whose house adjoins hers, put up a double extension. So, two heights.
Sure.
Goes up. So the ground floor and the first floor,
yeah.
Which is not architecturally in keeping with what's there already. It's just two boxes, one on top of the other, sort of flung up over the back.
Yeah.
But it's caused a crack to come down the side of my friend's house, about a foot wide at the top, I'm not joking, all the way down to the ground.
Yeah.
And she has been involved with the council. She has appealed. There's another appeal going on at the moment. She's very likely to lose. She won't be able to do anything about it. She has fallen out with the neighbours, obviously. They don't talk anymore, whereas their kids used to play together when they were little.
Sure.
And now she can't even sell her house because there's a major dispute going on with the neighbours and with the local council.
Honestly, it's absolutely shocking. A lot of people these days are stuck with flats they can't sell because of the Grenfell Tower situation, right?
Yeah.
It's hideous. I keep in touch with property because I own a bit of property myself. And my goodness, some people are being told they've got to spend £130,000 to right what's wrong in their properties. Because what happened with Grenfell was it wasn't just the cladding around the buildings. All of a sudden, they thought we ought to better inspect these buildings to see if there's any other problems. And a lot of buildings have been built without adequate fire safety precautions. But anyway, look, that's another matter, and it's a moaner, and we don't want to do that. All the time, Leslie and Miss Jones, we're, you know, looking at Megan and examining all that. Have we taken our eye off the ball about Kate, the Duchess of Cambridge, and what I think, in my opinion, she does a fantastic job, but I don't think she gets any credit for it.
I think she gets quite a lot. There was a documentary on television last night.
Oh, yeah.
It's the 10th anniversary of Kate and William's wedding.
Right.
And it was quite interesting, actually. I forget which channel it was on, but it they had her uncle, Gary, who's the brother of her mother, yeah. Carol, on there, and various other people, you know, the usual suspects, journalists, sure. and so on. And they took it right back to when Kate and William met at St. Andrews University.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten this, actually. She had a place at Edinburgh University.
Yes.
And she switched at the very last minute when it was announced publicly that William was going to St. Andrews. I think quite a lot of young ladies with their eye on the future king did the same thing.
Yeah.
But she ended up not only on the same course as William, but in the same hall of residence.
Yeah.
And so did she target him? It's never actually been stated, but it seems very likely that she did.
Yeah. I remember when they were at university, I read a story about William actually shouting to one of his mates. I think it was a student fashion show or something like that. Do you remember? And Kate
she was wearing the skirt as a dress, the see-through dress.
That's right, the see-through. And apparently William turned round in his very posh voice said, "Whoa, Kate's looking hot tonight."
Yeah, hot was the exact word he used. Yeah. Some people said that was a turning point. That he suddenly realized, you know, oh, there's something a bit more to this girl. But it's incredible how much they have, well, I say achieved. Is having children an achievement? Some people would say yes.
Well, I think having a stable family life when you're one of the most famous people in the world is an achievement, isn't it?
I think it is, and I think it's very common. I've similar scenarios going on in my own family, but people who've lost their mother at a very young age, especially men, tend to want to create the family hub, the family scenario to replace what they lost as children. And William has gone from one extreme to the other within the space of only a decade. It's quite amazing, really.
Yeah, it is absolutely incredible. Yeah. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky, myself, the Portmeister, and of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, we're getting some very nice feedback to our podcast at the moment, aren't we? And we've hit now nearly 2 million listens. So I think we have to say a big thank you to those who tune in.
Very grateful, and it's lovely to hear all the messages from people. The emails keep coming in. It's nice to know that we're making people's dog walks more enjoyable in the mornings.
Yes.
That we just bring a little light and joy to people's lives. It's that's why we're here.
Indeed. Now, without intruding on private life or family life and all that, Ms. Jones, you've had a rather exciting day, haven't you, just yesterday when you were celebrating your daughter's birthday. Can you tell us about that?
My youngest daughter, Bridie, turned 22. Where did that go?
Wow.
I was looking at, looking at baby pictures thinking, my goodness. But we're living in a nice new neighbourhood. So we've got a very nice royal park to go and have a walk in and a coffee and a croissant.
Yeah.
And because we have now a lovely roof garden, we're able to have Bridie's friends, which we did do, to lunch on the roof.
Super.
Obviously can't invite them into the house because we're not allowed to do that yet.
That's right, yeah.
But to have a gathering of six for lunch on the roof with heaters and food cooked by the mother and booze in full swing, very nice party.
Oh, super.
It's absolutely lovely.
Yeah, super. Now, I can tell you exclusively that yesterday I spent a day in a pub and it was quite legal, absolutely legal.
I thought that wasn't legal till next Monday.
Well, it was legal for me, and I'll tell you why. Because Monday, which is like only 2 days, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, 3 days away, I'll be doing, I've mentioned this before, I'll be doing a live show, Jeremy Vine on Five, because it's the opening of the pubs. And what the show's going to do is it's going to contrast me, excuse me, being in a pub that's open for the first time, the Pub Garden, for many, many months on Epsom Downs. It's a pub called, it's actually a pub restaurant, more of a restaurant than a pub, but it's called the Rubbing Horse. I beg your pardon, the Rubbing House, because it's where they used to rub the horses down, okay, on the edge of Epsom Downs. And I'll be doing that on Monday. So I had to go down yesterday and sort out the communications, you know, all the links and that kind of stuff, get the right sort of shot, the right view and all that kind of stuff. And it was glorious. And Jenny, who is the lady who runs that pub, insisted that I had a drop of vino whilst I was there. OK. And
so no money changed hands.
No money changed hands whatsoever. I tried to pay for it. This is absolutely true. Jenny wouldn't take my money. And as I tried to pay for it, I'm so embarrassed. I thought I better find like a £20 note or something because I can't offer them a credit card. So I delved into my pocket, pulled out what I thought was a £20 note, but in fact it was a lottery ticket, and I handed it to Jenny, and she said, "Why are you giving me a lottery ticket?" I said, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry, you know, because I meant to give her a £20 anyway." She wouldn't take it. She said, "Don't be ridiculous. We couldn't even take it off you if we wanted to, you know. You're a very welcome guest and all that kind of stuff." But it was absolutely fantastic, because I know the Rubbing House very well, because for years I've been going to the Derby. Your dad would have done the Derby, you know, every year at Epsom Downs, one of the great, great sporting events in the world of sport. And I looked out over Epsom Racecourse and Epsom Downs, and my heart just absolutely bled for the return to normality, because normally whenever I've been in the Rubbing House, there've been 100,000 people with me on the course. You know what I mean? It really did bring home to me that we've got to get back to the old life.
Yeah, I agree with you. And a lot of people are jumping up and down and looking forward to their first pint in however long. Yeah. But I do think we need to heed the warnings. The virus hasn't gone away. There are lots of mutations. We are going to be living with this for a long, long time to come. And masks and social distancing are features of our lives now. Yeah. And we can't take our foot off the accelerator and decide that it's all over, because it certainly isn't.
No, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I wear a mask now when I go out, just because I want to get into the nature of wearing a mask, you know what I mean? So I used to only wear it when I went in a shop or got on a train or something like that. I wear it all the time now because it's just easier. And also, if you're wearing a mask from the time you go out to the time you come back, then your hands aren't touching your mask, if you know what I mean. So, you're not in danger of impregnating yourself if you've touched something and you've got the virus. However, we've also got to learn to live with it in the same way that we had to learn to live with flu and that kind of stuff. People will die every year of COVID. You're absolutely right. It'll mutate. But fortunately, there'll be new vaccines every year. And, you know, I just want life to return to normal. I so do. It's blighted so many of our lives. Talking about lives and those that you've covered in your illustrious career, Ms. Jones, did you ever come across David Soul?
Yeah, I did. What a great singer he was at one point. I know that everybody raved about him on Starsky and Hutch and so on, and that was such a popular show back in the day. But he was a singer and a guitarist. He had some serious hits. Do you remember Don't Give Up On Us?
Don't give up on me, baby. I'm gonna give you a good time, or whatever.
Something like that, yeah. And then there was Silver Lady, and there was another one.
Oh, was it Silver Lady? Silver Lady.
Yeah, it sure brings out the love in your eyes, I think was another one of his. Two top 10 albums and four top 10 singles. He doesn't sing anymore, but I kind of wish he did, because he was one of those kind of smooth characters that the ladies all fell for.
Yeah.
And a bit middle of the road, but I rather liked it.
He's got a new show out, I was reading. I don't know what he's going to do. I mean, you say he's a singer and all that, but, you know, people wouldn't flock to Wembley, 100,000 of them, to listen to him singing, would they?
What, is this a live show or a television?
I don't know. I think it's a television show or something. But listen, you've talked about him as a singer. I mean, you know, you've missed the main point of his existence, in my view, and that's because he was half of Starsky and Hutch, wasn't he?
Well, I mentioned Starsky and Hutch in the first sentence. You weren't listening.
Oh, probably not, no. Probably got wax in my ears or something. No, I haven't got
what am I doing here, exactly?
Say?
What am I doing here? What am I doing here?
What are you doing here? No, listen, what I was going to say was...
If you don't listen to what I'm saying, what am I doing here?
Miss Jones, I listen to everything you say. I used to go out with a girl in New York, and whenever she got exasperated with me, she used to say, "What am I? Chopped liver?"
I love that expression.
Yeah, I know.
Chopped liver.
Yeah. And her other great expression was, whenever anything went wrong, she said, "I can't believe it, Michael. I went bananas." You know, and I love that expression, going bananas. Yes, yeah. Now, listen, Miss Jones, I wonder if you've been keeping up with the diaries of a failed politician called Alan Duncan.
I kind of read the first part and I thought, this is more of the same, really.
Exactly.
It's not that interesting to the vast majority
I totally
of us,
agree.
Is it?
I couldn't agree more with you. I think if you've been in politics and you want to write a political diary, do it with some depth, you know, do it with some insight, do it with something we don't know before. But this guy, Duncan, very wealthy, he was a trader in oil, I think, you know, and stocks and all that kind of stuff. Made himself very wealthy. Good luck to him. I like successful people, as you know, and like them to do well in life. But he never achieved it in politics. And all he's doing now, he's written a bitchy little diary in which he snipes at everybody, calls them names, you know, knocks them down and all that. That, to me, is not an insightful political diary. That's just getting your own back and hoping that people will like it because you're being a bit outrageous.
It's also very small-minded. You know, you need to take the moral high ground if you're going to do a book like that. Yes. And you also need to bring some humour into it. The great master of that genre, of course, was Alan Clark.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely.
And had some very saucy revelations to bring to the public.
Yeah, didn't he? He was a bit of a boy, wasn't he, old Alan Clark?
Wasn't he at one time he was shagging this whole family, the mother and all the daughters?
Yes, that's right, yes.
At the same time.
That's right, yeah.
That was the story.
Yeah. Well, he lived in a castle in Kent to start off with. So, he was very wealthy, lived in a castle in Kent and drove around in a sort of, you know, the last surviving E-type Jaguar or something like that. And you're quite right. He sort of worked his way through, you know, families, other females in the House of Commons. And, of course, you would frown upon all that, Miss Jones, and you might be right. But what's wrong with trying to enjoy your life? And if you like having sex with the opposite sex, I can't say anything wrong with it, frankly.
Well, I'm not going to moralise here because that's not my game. But imagine if you are that mother or you are those daughters. And the thing you have in common now is not the fact that you share DNA, but that you all share the same bloke in bed. How do you get past that?
Well,
How do you spend the next Christmas around the table and over the turkey knowing what you know, that you've all been betrayed and also that you've all betrayed each other?
Well, were they betrayed? I mean, can't you have, like, sex with somebody else of the opposite sex and just think, yeah, this is great, but not have an emotional attachment to them? And therefore, why do you care who else they've been having sex with?
Because all those women thought they were in a relationship with him.
I don't think they did.
Yes, they did. And they were all cheating on other women because they found out he was seeing other people.
Yeah.
And then eventually they found out that the people they were cheating on were their own siblings and their own mother.
Oh, well, yeah, I think you take it too seriously. I think it was casual relationships, you know. And
I don't think they thought that.
Well, okay. I'll take your view on it. On politicians, again, a bit more serious. Joe Biden, the new president of the United States of America, and I think his 100 days is coming up quite soon and all that kind of stuff. But what a tragic family life that man's had, eh?
Yeah, that was, I mean, awful when you think it was a few days before Christmas, wasn't it, when his first wife and his little daughter, baby daughter, were killed in a car accident.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So there was that to deal with first. And then the other siblings growing up had the loss of their sibling to come to terms with.
Yeah.
But then later on, it's his son Hunter, isn't it? He's gone through many years of a drug addiction and trying to overcome narcotics abuse and so on. Yeah, he's obviously a very strong man. The media like to portray him, Biden, that is, Joe, as a bit frail and a bit past it.
I
think there must be a very intense strength in that man to have overcome so much.
When I worked in America in the 80s and early 90s, everybody in the pub, Costello's, which we all used to talk about Joe Biden. You know, who said that? Joe Biden. He was talked about. And he was a young man then. It was 40 years ago, 35, 40 years ago. And now I know you're always accused me of not listening to you, Miss Jones, but have you mentioned the son who died as well?
Was he the one called Beau? Absolutely right.
Well done. And he died of a brain tumour or brain cancer or something like that. He's had a horrendously tragic life. And as you quite rightly say, to most people, when an individual tragedy hits you like that, would just give up and say, my life is meaningless without my son that I've lost, without the wife and the child that I lost, and how can I go on? And in a way, you know, we've seen it in this country, haven't we, with Gordon Brown, who lost a child very, very early in life, with David Cameron, who lost a child at the age of about 10 or something like that. It must be the most horrendous thing to do. And then to have to go back into public life and perform again, I don't know how they do it.
No, I don't either. To lose a child is the worst thing that can happen to anybody.
Yeah.
For your own child to predecease you.
Yeah.
Even if they have got illnesses or conditions, such as Ivan Cameron did have, didn't he?
Yes.
He was a very disabled boy, but
he was
still their son. And of course, they loved him. So that must have been an awful loss to them.
Yeah.
Having said that, I used to have a lot of respect for David Cameron, but I feel very strongly he let us down over the whole Brexit thing.
Right.
And now it's emerging that he's been lobbying for his friends' businesses in Parliament.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all come to light.
Yeah.
Very self-serving, because he stood to benefit from that financially.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I'm finding him a bit chinless these days.
Well, I'm finding him more than chinless. I can't believe the revelations that are coming out now. I mean, since he stood down as Prime Minister, and you're absolutely right. Look, whether you were for Europe or against Europe, Cameron got it completely wrong, because what he should have done is he should have stood aside as Prime Minister and said, look, we're going to have a vote on it. We'll give you the pros and the cons and you decide. But he didn't. He and George Osborne launched Project Fear and said, because they wanted to stay in Europe, they launched Project Fear and said, you know, it'll be damning and dangerous to the country if we stay in Europe. And actually, the country reacted against that by saying, who are you to tell me which way to vote and all that kind of stuff, you know. So I thought he was a poor politician. But you're absolutely right. It's emerged now since he left office that he was, the minute he stood down, he was going to fill his own pockets. And he has been the backer of some businessman whose way of life is allegedly so bad, I wouldn't say corrupt because it's not been proven it's corrupt, but so bad that guy like Cameron should never have aligned himself with these people. I don't know why politicians do that.
There's a desperation that creeps in, isn't there? His the usual route to wealth post number 10 is to write the memoir. And he did write the memoir, but it failed miserably. Nobody bought it. It was remaindered very quickly, and he didn't make his fortune from that.
Right.
So probably in desperation to keep the lifestyle going, because it must cost a lot of money to run him and his family.
Yes.
I know he gets protection for life for that kind of thing, because all prime ministers do. But that's, you know, that's only a drop in the ocean of the total bill to run a lifestyle like his.
That's
so
true.
He's probably in desperation, he's got into bed with some unsavory types, and now it's come back to bite him on the bum.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Have you got to get serious, Miss Jones, because you know, we're serious broadcasters. Have you had your council tax bill for this year?
Yeah.
I can't believe it. I just can't believe it.
So many add-ons, and it's more expensive than it's ever been.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, you've got these council fat cats earning 250 grand a year. What's that about?
Unbelievable. If you get down to the figures, I'm sure I'm right, but I'll happily concede if one of our listeners can prove differently. 30% of your council tax bill now is to pay for the pensions of people who've worked there, because it's public money. These local authorities just, you know, take people on, pile on the numbers, you know, build themselves empires. And it's not just having to pay for them at the time, you've got to pay for them for the rest of your life. And I think that's grotesque.
I do as well. I'm not really very happy about it. So I have actually written to my new local council and asked them to review what they're proposing to charge me. Let's see what comes back.
Well done, Miss Jones, campaigner against against profligate local councils. You are becoming a heroine of mine, Miss Jones. Well, you already are, actually, but it's another string to your bow. Did you ever come across Mylene Klass?
Yeah,
she's 43 this week.
Yeah, she's a very talented girl, and I wish her a happy birthday. But there's something about her I don't like, I'm afraid. She's a very sore loser, for a start. Yes. She's a sore loser. I happened to be at my mother's, as I usually am on a Sunday, during the most recent run of Dancing on Ice. And it was the episode in which she was fired. So she was voted off. And she was extremely miffed about this. She she didn't take it at all well. Yeah. Very ungracious, very cross about it. Mm. Cross is her kind of default setting, I think.
Right.
She's had a lot of sort of quite ill-advised relationships with her bodyguards and all the usual stuff. You know, it's all a bit predictable. It's like the rock star running off with the nanny kind of thing. When The Sound of Music was on the other day, and of course the captain runs off with the nanny, and you think it's such a cliche.
Yeah.
But of course that kind of thing happens with women as well.
Yeah.
But usually it's the bodyguard with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I think she's all right, isn't she? But she's not my cup of tea.
I think you've been a bit kind of. I mean, to start off with, she's incredibly good looking. You have to say, high cheekbones.
I think she looks a bit like a mouse.
Oh dear me, Miss Jones. Yeah, the old bitchiness again. What happened to the sisterhood, Miss Jones? I think she's incredibly good looking, and I think she's elegant, and I couldn't believe how talented she is. She plays the piano, the violin, and the harp. How many people do you know play the harp, right?
Well, I know lots of multi-instrumentalists. She is her personality, really. I know that she's talented. Yeah. I do acknowledge that.
Yeah.
There's just something about her that rubs me up the wrong way.
Okay. Now, what I couldn't believe is, with all that musical talent, how did she ever get herself into a group? Was it called Hearsay? There was her, there was one other woman, and there was a really thick lad who didn't seem to be able to do anything except sort of lip sync to their two hits they had or something like that. Why would she have got into that? I suppose because it was a way of making herself known, wasn't it?
Look, when you're very young, you've got to start somewhere, haven't you,
it's true. It's true. It takes Spice Girls. I mean, you're absolutely right. They all lived together in a house in Watford, didn't they? And became very, very famous. Miss Jones.
Well, took some amazing songwriting and some incredible production to put that together. But they did have a string of incredible hits, the Spice Girls.
They did. And by the way, individually, I thought they all had a talent. Even Jerry, everybody said, well, she wasn't a singer, she wasn't a dancer. What was she? Well, she was Jerry, wasn't she? And she pushed herself to the front and made herself her personality. And I think you have to admire people who do that.
Massive attitude as well, and that sort of oozed out of them. They were fearless, weren't they?
Yeah.
And I think they were role models for young girls during the late 90s.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Now, Miss Jones, as I know, you keep your eye on everything that happens in this world. You're very shrewd and very bright, and you will have noticed that a company called Deliveroo was floated on the stock exchange a few days ago, well, last week, actually, and it failed. I don't know a lot about the way stock exchanges work, but apparently, you know, when you say you're going to float your company, you look at a projected figure that the shares will take off at, and Deliveroo shares fell very, very, like, you know, 20% or something like that, didn't reach it. And apparently it's a disaster, so billions of pounds have been lost and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, business aside, how much do you depend on takeaway food? Because Deliveroo brought together all the strands of, you know, pizza, Chinese, Indian, even McDonald's. How much do you rely on takeaway food?
Ah, well, you see, I issued a ban on Deliveroo quite some time ago when my family and I were all still living together because they are a sloppy company. The food always arrived cold.
Really?
I think that they did the rounds. You know, there was usually a bloke on a bike or on a motorcycle or something, and they would deliver several lots of food to various households at once.
Right.
So by the time you got your pizza or whatever it was cold.
Really?
And I object to that kind of thing. And they also make a takeaway very expensive.
Yeah.
So I said to my kids, you know, we try not to have takeaways very often, but maybe once or twice a month if we ordered food.
Yes.
It would only be if the restaurant could deliver it to us themselves. So it would be somewhere local.
Yeah, I agree.
Or that we could just walk down the road and get it.
Well, that's what I do. You're absolutely right. 5 minutes from where I live, I can walk down to the end of my street, which is a lovely leafy street in Surrey, you know, with trees and all that. But if I turn right and walk another 5 minutes, I then come into a small town. And there is a Domino's Pizza, there's a Chinese takeaway, there's an Indian takeaway, and what else is there? No, I was at McDonald's about another 200 yards on. And I do exactly what you've said. Why sit here waiting for somebody to deliver your food when they feel they can, when you can take control and go and get it? And you quite rightly say, I sometimes turn the oven. Oh, fish and chips is the other place, of course, that I go to. Sometimes I turn the oven on before I go out so that when I bring it back after a 5 minute walk, excuse me, I can put it in the oven and keep it hot. You see what I mean?
Yeah, you know, but there's no substitute for cooking at home, is there really? So a takeaway is, it tends to be with us, something like a Thai dinner if everybody wants something different. You know, when you cook at home, you more or less cook the same thing for everybody to eat together.
Yeah.
It's not very often that I'll cook two or three different types of meal at the same time.
Of course
not. So if they want a Thai dinner or a Chinese or Indian, something like that, when everybody wants something different, it makes sense to get it from a local restaurant. But I'm not a fan of Deliveroo, and I'm not at all surprised that their share price fell through the floor.
Right.
Because I think people are waking up to the fact that it is a very expensive way to eat.
Right. You see, I find all that interesting. I don't know what it costs because I never look at prices. You know, I know that sounds arrogant, but not many of us do. You know, do you ever, when your credit card bill comes in, you don't examine it, do you? And say, oh, how much was that? How much is that? You just give over a piece of plastic for most of your life now and you just pay it. But it's interesting what you say. What I would say to cooking at home is, there are some things you can't cook at home. So, for instance, I love a Domino's pizza, and I love it freshly out of their oven and get it home as quickly as you can and just keep it warm and eat it. I can't cook pizza at home that tastes anything like that. I can't cook fish and chips at home that tastes like fish and chips out of the fish and chip shop. I can't cook Chinese takeaway that tastes like Chinese takeaway. So you must have culinary skills way above mine, because actually, takeaway food for me is better than food I cook at home.
But how often do you eat it?
Oh, twice a week, maybe.
Oh, really? That's quite high, isn't it?
Fish and chips once a week, Chinese takeaway once a week, something like that, you know. And
that's eight takeaways a month. That is quite a lot.
Well, yeah, but...
So you just need to be aware of your salt and sugar intake, Michael. You need to
pass. Don't worry. You know, I've got diabetes too. I've got a dodgy heart. I'm suffering terrible sciatica at the moment, as I think I told you, which I'm trying to get better, but there we are.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I need to talk to you about those exercises. I need to give you a demonstration sometime.
Demonstration? Come on, Miss Jones. This is a family show, you know. Right, okay. So, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. Thank you to all our listeners. The world is waking up, and the next time we communicate with our millions of followers and listeners, Ms. Jones, it'll be the day of, the day after Pub Garden opening, and I'll be able to relate my tale of Pub Garden opening day one. Do you have a plan? Have you booked yourself a table somewhere?
I thought about it. We discussed it. You know, we thought, actually, we're not going to get in anywhere. If you have to book, the thing about going to the pub, I've always thought, is the spontaneity of it.
Totally
you can, you know, you want, when we worked on Fleet Street, you could wander out in the street, bump into somebody and go, oh, do you fancy a quick drink? You know, you could just run in somewhere spontaneously.
Yes.
So, no, we haven't booked anywhere. And I think we're just going to see how it goes.
I totally agree with you. I haven't booked anywhere either. As I said, I'm going to the Rubbing House on Epsom Downs day after tomorrow, and that'll be lovely. But I totally agree with you. It's like booking a restaurant, isn't it? And by the way, let's just define a quick drink to our millions of listeners. It usually lasted about 6 hours, didn't it?
Yeah, unless you had to go back to work.
Yeah.
What I have done, because a few friends of mine have done likewise, I've booked a table at the Woolsey restaurant on Monday, the 17th of May.
That's a top restaurant for the benefit of our listeners who are lucky enough to live outside of London. The Woolsey's a top one, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And a few people I know are going along there that night. And so I've booked a table and I thought the first night of freedom, I am going to go and do that. So, that should be a good reunion that night, I think.
It'll be absolutely fantastic. Right. OK, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. Thank you to all our listeners. And I can't end this podcast without saying hooray to the opening of the pubs again. Miss Jones, we'll talk again very soon.
Take it easy, Mike. Stay safe.
I read a story about William actually shouting to one of his mates. I think it was a student fashion show or something like that. Do you remember? And Kate came.
She was wearing the skirt as a dress, the see-through dress.
That's right, the see-through. And apparently, William turned round in his very posh voice, said, "Whoa, Kate's looking hot tonight."
Yeah, hot was the exact word he used. Yeah, some people said that was a turning point, that he suddenly realised, something a bit more to this guy.
He's got a new show out, I was reading. I don't know what he's going to do. I mean, you say he's a singer and all that, but, you know, people wouldn't flock to Wembley, 100,000 of them, to listen to him singing, would they?
What, is this a live show or a television?
I don't know, I think it's a television show or something. But listen, you've talked about him as a singer. I mean, you know, you've missed the main point of his existence, in my view, and that's because he was half of Starsky and Hutch, wasn't he?
Well, I mentioned Starsky and Hutch in the first sentence. You weren't listening.
No, probably not, no. Probably got wax in my ears or something. No, I've got
what wax. Am I doing here, exactly?
Say?
What am I doing here?
What are you doing here? No, listen, what I was going to say was...
If you don't listen to what I'm saying, what am I doing here?
Listen, Miss Jones, I listen to everything you say. I'm suffering terrible sciatica at the moment, as I think I told you, which I'm trying to get better, but there we are.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I need to talk to you about those exercises. Yes, I need to give you a demonstration sometime.
Demonstration? Come on, Miss Jones, this is a family show, you know.